Hello and welcome to the Soccer Coach Weekly podcast with me, Steph Fairbairn. Thank you for joining us as we get insights and ideas from coaches working across the game to help you develop into the coach you want to be. This episode, I'm joined again by Maritz Kosman. Maritz has just taken on a new role, leaving Ubuntu Football to become DSTV Disky Challenge coach and head of youth at Cape Town City. Congratulations to Maritz. We wish him all the best of luck at his new club. When we caught up this time, we talked about passing, looking at how it can be used as a form of communication, why the actions after a pass are so crucial, and the decision-making that goes into choosing to pass. First, though, we started with a definition.
Passing has been a thing for the last 140 years and an instrumental part of our game. The game started off, as we know, with more of a running and kicking kind of vibe to it or situation action pattern to it. And then I think it was the Scottish that introduced passing to the game. And my friend René Maric said once that that was the biggest ever evolution to the game of soccer or football. And I think that still holds true. That's the biggest single evolution to the game. And yeah, in my definition, or in a universal definition, perhaps passing is giving the ball to a teammate of ours. And that could be with any legal part of the body. So, you know, we can pass the ball with the foot. It's obviously the most prominent way to do it. Probably the one that happens by a large distance the most in the game. Most often with the instep of the foot, sometimes with the outside of the foot. Over longer distances, it could be with the laces, as you might call it, or the top of your foot. But it can also theoretically be with anything else. You could pass with the chest, you could pass with the knee, you could pass with the head. And obviously, some of those happen more often than others. But passing is the action of passing the ball, giving it to our teammate. And yeah, I think that will also lead us to that definition will also lead us to a definition of what constitutes a good pass. Sometimes when we look at football training, and this is a relatively universal topic, that there's this over-focus on passing, but an over-focus that takes passing out of the context. I'm not in any way disputing that passing is a crucial action in the game. And I think if we analyze a game of football statistically, then we would find that passing is the most frequent action in the game by a long way. However, we need to get away from this notion of training passing for the sake of passing. So a good pass, in my book, is a pass to a teammate in a better position. A better position can be defined in relation to multiple factors, but that also means that if no teammate is in a better position, then why do I need to pass the ball? Because if I pass the ball for the sake of passing, it could very well create worse situations for the team, but there's not really a point to it. So a big part of teaching players at all levels about passing, it's not just the technical action, but it's also the idea of understanding why I'm passing and when it makes sense, and then to build from there.
You've given us so much to delve into there. I suppose let's start with the technical, and then we'll move on to the more decision-making stuff that you've spoken about. So you mentioned different parts of the body, different parts of the foot. Could you go a bit more into what different types of passes there are and the techniques we might use with them?
Yeah, I think the most common one would be to pass with the instep of our foot. So, you know, the inside, which, yeah, it happens most often in the game. There's certain situations where we might use that more often than others. So, for example, over shorter and medium distances, let's say, you know, obviously this short and medium distances vary according to the age of our players. So some really young players, you know, a 15 meter pass might be a long distance, but for most footballers at different levels, 15 meters is still relatively short. So you would use an instep technique over a shorter distance. The reason for that, it's the most easily executed technically because you're using a large surface area of your foot. So you have a bigger margin of error when kicking the ball compared to other parts of the foot. Because yeah, there's a larger, let's call it sweet spot, where you can hit the ball. A disadvantage of using the instep is that it's relatively predictable. So opponents can see you pass the ball, where you're going to pass to, kind of more easily than if you use, for example, the outside of the foot. But so it's a little bit more obvious what you're going to do. And obviously this technique has limits over larger distance. So if you want to pass, let's say a 40 meter pass or a 60 meter pass even, then it will be difficult to achieve enough power with the instep. Another advantage though, is that when you're passing with the instep, you generally will create a top spin on the ball. So you're not going to sort of side spin the ball or undercut it too much because of this sort of larger sweet spot and larger surface area. And if you're top spinning the ball, if it's rolling towards your teammate, it becomes easier to control as well. So there's an aspect of safety to it. But then you look at the other parts, the outside of the foot, it's a smaller surface area and the ball's going to spin more, but it's unpredictable. It's very unpredictable. And therefore, you might see a larger proportion of outside of the foot, one-touch passes in the final third. Or the same goes for using toes just to poke the ball through. It's less predictable. It's a small surface area, but you get a very quick action from it. So it's also something that maybe gets used more in tighter situations, 50-50 situations, or in the final third. And then, as I said, we have the heel that could be used, again, unpredictable. And the top of the foot, the laces or whatever you want to call it, which might be very useful for really longer passing action. Then the other parts of the body would come into play more when we're talking about aerial duels or messy sort of 1v1 or 2v2 situations in a really tight space. Then you might need to pass with your head or even your chest to get rid of it very quickly, or your knee, if you want to be unconventional. I think, if I'm not mistaken, in futsal, for example, that kind of action is a little bit more common sometimes. But yeah, those are obviously more exceptions to the rule if we take a normal footballing situation as a starting point. So the different parts of the foot come into play, obviously, much, much more often.
I suppose if we start with the... start with the start of the action then. When players are kind of about to pass or looking to pass, how can they set themselves up effectively to do so?
It's similar to shooting in a way that you have to put your non-kicking foot next to the ball. Most likely you would lean back slightly, which gives you a nice solid body position. And that's really a key to most passing actions, is that your body is in a position that supports your kicking foot from a solid base, so that you have a stable base and therefore don't lose body shape as you're kicking the ball. Obviously, when you kick the ball, a force goes through your body, which means you could go off or balance, which then leads the ball to go astray. So it's very key to learn to support the kicking action of the ball with the non-kicking leg and the body position behind the ball. Obviously, the exact details differ according to which part of the foot we might use. For example, if I am using the heel, then I don't need to lean back. But if I'm kicking with the instep or the laces, then I need to lean back slightly, and I probably also need to use the arm on the far side. Let's say I'm kicking with my right foot, then my left arm would also contribute largely to balancing my body by swinging out. Whereas if I'm kicking with the heel, then that doesn't necessarily have to happen. Also, obviously, how we pass the ball differs from person to person. So the genetic makeup of our players will play a role in how exactly they perform the techniques. But in it, as generally speaking, that would be sort of the main basic points. Now, the key is where you hit the ball. And I think that is very, very underrated, is learning to kick the ball in certain positions. A simple one is, if I want to hit the ball in the middle, it will stay on the ground and it will be easy for it to stay down. If I want to kick the ball in the air, then I must hit the ball at the bottom so that it can, I'm kicking, the force comes from beneath, and so then the ball goes up. But in exceptional circumstances, and I think we saw players like Mesut Ozil was one that I can remember, that would sometimes kick the ball higher and then it would bounce it into the ground and kick it over, let's say, an opponent. Now, that's a very, very exceptional and unusual technique that perhaps we shouldn't focus an enormous amount of time on in team training. But for the sake of completion and for the sake of interest, it is possible to do that. Another way is obviously to kick it slightly on the sides to achieve a spin. And that perhaps we would use with free kicks or corner kicks or crosses to achieve this spin from outside or from inside to outside or outside to inside, depending on whether we're using the instep or the outside of our foot for that.
What about the ways then we can manipulate the weight of the pass or the distance that the pass travels?
I think that's such a crucial point you're raising there, actually, and very, very underrated, is to learn to pass appropriately to the situation. And I would relate that to two factors, the distance that I'm passing over, as well as the amount of opponents that I'm trying to beat with my pass. So if I am passing over a short distance to a teammate and there's no opposition players close to the pathway of the ball, well, then I don't need to pass very hard, because my ultimate aim and purpose of passing is to give the ball to a teammate that is in a better position, but also to make that teammate's life as easy as possible, because the more we set them up for a successful action, the more likely they are to complete a successful act. And so we need to have foresight in our action. And if the teammate is under no pressure, well, then we don't need to smash the ball hard into their foot, because if we do that, then it's more likely that they will lose the ball and create a turnover of a technical mistake. But if I am trying to pass to a teammate that is 20 meters in front of me, there are four opponents close to the pathway of the ball in between, well, then I have to pass much harder, because it's a longer distance and because we're running the risk of an interception. And so for our players, they need to also learn to make passing actions appropriate to different situations of the game. And the higher level we go, the more we will see that players have this ability to slightly vary their actions. So to make slightly different actions in slightly different situations. So we Raymond for Hire uses the metaphor of a toolkit. So they have a more skilled player has got 50 different hammers, metaphorically speaking, for 50 slightly different situations, where a less skilled player has two hammers and applies them to every situation. So the slight variance of weight of the pass is crucial in terms of game understanding, reading the game, but also performing actions that with foresight that help our teammates that are going to receive the ball, but without creating more likelihood of turnovers.
On that point about teammates receiving or passing to teammates, how important is communication between teammates and all of that?
the game starts with communication or interaction, where we can look at our teammates and communicate with them verbally while via talking. We can also communicate with body language. We can, when we've played together with a teammate for several years, then it becomes much easier to read one another. You know, if we go to the highest level of the game and we take, for example, the partnership between a Kevin De Bruyne and Erling Haaland, then when they play in a stadium of 60,000 people that are all roaring and screaming, I don't think that there's massive amounts of verbal communication going on compared to the amount of nonverbal communication that is going on. And I think that is where, at a high level, it becomes key to have players that play together, your strongest 11 to play together as much as possible, because then you learn to communicate in a nonverbal and ever more subtle way. And the more subtle this communication becomes, the more likely it is to create small space and time advantages compared to our opponents. And perhaps it's this what some would call intuitive understanding is really more nonverbal communication. And yeah, when De Bruyne does certain things, Haaland might understand that the ball is going to come here or there. And then that gives him the chance to start his run slightly earlier than the opponent, and then gives him enough space to finish the ball. Plus, you know, you take someone like De Bruyne, who can technically deliver perfect passes in the final third very often. I think it's a good example of communication on a football field. But we can obviously at a lower level also communicate very verbally, but how we pass the ball also is a communication. So if I pass the ball to your furthest foot, I might, if I'm a skilled player who's able to pass the ball accurately, then I might be communicating to you to make a forward action, because I've passed it to your furthest foot. I am trying to tell you to go forward and to attack with your first touch. But if I'm passing it to your nearest foot, the one that is closest to me in relation to the opponent goal and where you are on the field, then I might be communicating to you that there's quite a large amount of opposition pressure behind you, and you might be better served just controlling the ball and passing it backwards again. So that's a very simple way of using passing for communications. Obviously, a more prominent example is to pass the ball into space. Well, then I'm communicating to you to go forward. Passing it to feet, I might be communicating to you to pass to a teammate again. And, you know, there was this famous Bielsa statement that I think there's over 30 ways to communicate with a pass. And I don't have 30 ways right now for us to go through, but it's certainly possible, especially when you've played with someone else for a long time and you have a high level of skill, to very subtly communicate through the way I'm passing. And that could also be the spin I'm putting on the ball. That could be the power on the pass. For example, if I'm passing it quite hard to you, then I might be suggesting to use one touch only. If I'm passing softer, I might be trying to draw out opposition pressure. Now, if I'm passing it medium hard, I might be suggesting not to use one touch, and so on and so forth. So passing can also be, or is also, a form of communication, but yeah, it's crucial to interact efficiently on the football field. And that is where football actions start, really.
You've mentioned one touch there. I suppose you want to delve into that a little bit more. I'm thinking also there's passing from static situations on the field, right? There's throw-ins, free kicks, goal kicks, where you've got kind of a really calm running start to that. Then there's passing while you're kind of in the game, and sometimes that's a touch and another pass, sometimes that's one touch. If my question makes sense, could you speak to some of those a little bit more?
Of course. I would differentiate between static situations and dynamic situations in football actions. And a dynamic situation, for example, would be you passing the ball into space, your teammate is running onto it, and then he crosses or they cross to another teammate that is making a run into the box. So that's a very dynamic situation. There's movement, the ball is moving, players are moving, and there's, it's ever changing very quick. And then a static situation might be, for example, a throw it to start with or a free kick. And I would say, generally speaking, static situations more favor the defending team, whereas dynamic situations, because of their ever-changing nature, they favor the attacking teams. So as passing is an attacking situation, we might be trying to create dynamic situations, even from static situations. So I think that is one very important part of that. And when we come to the touches on the ball, I think there it's crucial to teach our players the different positions or the different field positions as a factor to consider. So obviously one touch passing has the advantage that the ball changes position very quick. So it's difficult for the defending team to react to the ball changing positions several times, even very quickly. And because the ball's changing position quickly, we're now creating dynamic situations with one-touch passing, which is also why you would see a throw-in. Very often, the first player receiving from a throw-in takes one touch only. That's very common that we see that player pass the ball back to the thrower, for example. So one-touch passes are very helpful to create dynamic situations and also to change situations quickly. And then with that quick change, we are more and more likely to create space and time for our players. The difficulty is that even at a very high level, one-touch passes, to execute them technically, successfully, all the time, is very, very difficult to do. And that's why they have a certain place on the field. For example, in my teams, I would not encourage a lot of one-touch passing in the build-up third. So in let's call it defensive third, I would not sort of ask for many one-touch passes. There are exceptional situations where we can use them, of course. I'm not going to restrict so hard to never allow it. But generally, because they are technically difficult to execute, and because there's a large risk associated to losing the ball in your own third, I would not encourage it tremendously in that area of the pitch. However, in the final third, where it's all about chance creation and it's all about risk taking, because football is a low scoring sport, it is just part of the game that we are going to have more unsuccessful attacks than what we will have successful attacks. And so we need to take risks in the final third, and one-touch passes are risky, but it can be tremendously effective in our chance creation attempts. I think if you look at a team like RB Leipzig, who won the German Cup, we will see that they have some really fantastic one-touch combinations in and around the box of the opponent. And so in the modern game, that is really a big part of successful teams, but it happens more in the final third. Now, if we look at more touches on the ball, perhaps using two touches or more, then of course it depends on the situations, but in the build-up third, I would very much encourage players to take more than one touch, because it not only is it easier to be controlled with the ball, but it's also an advantage to draw opposition pressure towards you to then create free teammates who, as we said in the beginning, are more likely to be in a better position than you as the passer. And therefore, it becomes easier for us to advance the game. In the build-up third, drawing pressure is really, really a crucial aspect. And it's difficult to do that with one touch, because you have the ball for such a short period of time that the opponent might very well not even close you down, but they can then very quickly change direction towards the teammate that is receiving the ball. So perhaps a useful idea is that in my build-up third, I will only use one touch if I'm passing to a teammate that is already completely open, or if I'm in a difficult situation under a lot of pressure where I need to get an exit. That would be sort of my exceptions to that general consideration.
How important then is our action after the pass and what we're doing to move the game on?
Crucial. Again, really good point. I think there's a lot of talk about pre-actions before receiving the pass. And we've talked about receiving before and, open body positions, scanning. A lot of that is very prominent nowadays already with coaches. But the action after passing the ball is just as crucial because, we're looking at creating the dynamic situations. And in order to do that, we need to have movement. And what we don't want is American football quarterbacks on our team, to use a metaphor. And what I mean with that is the quarterback might stand in the pocket and then passes the ball, but then his contribution to that play, to that action is finished. He's done after he's passed the ball. Whereas football is a dynamic sport. So after I've passed the ball, again, I become a teammate that needs to move into open space. I think I wrote about it a couple of months ago that, passing and moving was the basic, most crucial principle to a team like Liverpool, even already in the 1980s and 70s, when they won the European Cup several times. It was all about passing and moving. So I make a pass and I move it to space to receive the ball again, but even also just to create a more dynamic situation, which makes it easy for the teammate on the ball. And we can even see that in the modern game, where certain teams like Hamburg in Germany in the second Bundesliga, they do a lot of passing and moving, even in the build-up, where a centre-back might pass to a full-back, but then moves into space in front of the ball. And so this action after making an action on the ball is very underrated, but it's very, very important because we want dynamic, more dynamic situations on attack. And that is one of the best ways to create that. And it's also just great individual coaching for players to understand that once they've given the ball to a teammate, they again become an off-the-ball teammate. And so we can greatly increase the amount of useful actions that our players make by coaching this aspect. So yeah, I really like that you brought that up.
You've mentioned then, I suppose, in various forms, loads of stuff around decision-making. But I suppose if we could summarize it, when a player is on the ball, they're thinking about what to do next, what might their thought process be? What kind of pictures are they seeing? What might lead them to make the correct decision of making a pass?
I think we have to highlight that as the level of the game increases, the space and time to make decisions definitely decreases. And we can also, through analysis, see that in the last 20, 30 years, the amount of time that players have on the ball before they are put under pressure by the opponent is becoming less and less. And so at a higher level, or the highest level, it becomes really key to already have a good idea of where to pass the ball before you receive the ball, and to perhaps not make that decision when you've already received. At the same time, it's very crucial to play with your head up. So to be looking up and scanning the situation, because as you are looking up, you might be better able to react to small changes that happen in situations. Where to pass the ball to is related to a few factors. So firstly, it's related to the opponent. If I am free in space, but you are marked by two opponents, then it might not be a very good idea to pass to you. But because there's two opponents that are close to you and marking you, my third teammate might be completely open, and so I can pass there. So the first factor to consider is your position. The second factor to consider is the position on the field. So if I have the ball when I am in my own half, but you are completely free in the opposition half, so closer towards the target that you're trying to go to, well, then it makes sense for me to give you the ball. A third factor is your teammates. So if I'm giving you the ball, but you are in the opposition half and there's enough space for you to receive, that's good. But what if there's no teammates close to you at all? What if you are completely isolated? Well, then it might still not be such a good idea to pass the ball to you, because you might find it difficult to now make a successful follow-up action because there's no teammates close enough to you. So that for me would be the three most key aspects: position of the opposition, position of your teammate, and position on the field. But of course, there's other subtle factors that also play into it, such as situation of the game. Does it make sense to pass forward if we're leading 2-1 in the 89th minute? Actions that you have made. Perhaps you just made a run into the depth and then lost the ball and then had to press the opposition. And now you're completely out of breath. You're in a good position on the field, but maybe I shouldn't give you the ball because you're going to struggle physically to make another action. So there's small, subtle things like that that play in. Another sounds maybe a little bit mean, but another factor that definitely plays into the decision-making process of players is the success that the teammate has had. So if the teammate has lost the ball 6 out of 7 times on the ball in the last 5 minutes, well, then I'm just less likely to give the ball to that teammate, because we don't lose it as individuals. We lose it as a team. Players definitely will factor implicitly the success of teammates into their passing decision-making process. So as I said, there's many small factors, but the ones that we should focus on is the position of the opponent, position of teammates, and position on the field. We want to make passes that are given to teammates that are in better positions than us. And that means either they are closer to our target or they are less likely to lose the ball, or ideally both.
Do you have some go-to sessions then that you might use to coach passing?
Absolutely. I think as we've now discussed quite extensively, we've figured out that passing is not just the kicking action, but an action that is done, performed in relation to the game. So ideally, we should train this as much as possible, or as early as possible with opposition pressure, because the opposition is a crucial factor in constituting a pass versus constituting a kicking action. And so even when I'm training with players at a lower level, as much opposition pressure as possible is good. An example of that would be to make a directional passing game in a 5v3 diamond towards 2 mini goals. I think what is very, very popular in common sort of coaching practice is to make passing patterns without opposition pressure. And I'm not going to say that that is a bad exercise, because it's not. And there's certainly times and places where that could be used, but it doesn't offer the different orientation points that the game offers to make a decision-making process. And so what I have done a lot is take these passing patterns as a starting point, but convert them into exercises with opposition pressure and with direction towards a mini goal most often, which then, it often provides similar kicking patterns to a passing exercise without opposition pressure, but it does so with variation, with difference, and with opponents helping to provide the different orientation points that you require for a transfer to the game. So a 5v3 passing game towards a small target in a diamond field would be very much a go-to practice for me. Another consideration, and again, I really like rondos as a starting point to training, but we do need to consider that in most rondos, things are done from a static starting point. So players stand in more or less the same spot and then pass to teammates. Obviously, in a rondo, I've got opposition pressure, so that's very good, but it's done relatively static. So as a coach, I might need to consider different ways to make the rondo more dynamic or use a possession practice. And a good example of that might be a 5+3 wall player or versus 5+3 wall player practice, or you could use a end-to-end practice with two neutral wall players on either end of the field, two teams of four players in the middle, trying to pass the ball without losing it from one target towards the other. The first practice that I name now is perhaps a possession practice where there will be a bigger focus on keeping the ball as a team, whereas the second one, the end-to-end, might be one where there's a bigger focus on creating forward passing options. And so the advantage, though, of both of them is that they both provide the opportunity to practice passing in dynamic situations and with movement. And so perhaps they are slightly closer related to the game than a traditional rondo ball would be.
If we think about then the player's journey from kind of beginner all the way through to more experience, what do you think the building blocks around passing are and how do they build up?
I think the first part is to learn to pass with the instep, for sure, because it's the easiest technique to learn and it's also the one that's most commonly used. Then the next step is to learn to use the different parts of the foot. So the outsides, the laces, the heel. Then we go from there towards learning to use the other parts of the body, but also learning to play in bigger playing areas or at a higher level again in smaller areas, but with a lot of opposition pressure. That then also means that perhaps there's a bigger focus on the one-touch action as you get older compared to when you were younger, but there's also a bigger focus on playing in larger areas. As you get older, obviously, we start playing with bigger teams. So we go from perhaps playing in a 3v3 to playing in an 11v11 eventually. And because we're playing in teams with larger amount of opponents and teammates, it means that the decision-making process in our passing becomes more and more complex by definition, because now there's more factors to consider, larger playing area, more teammates, more opponents that are going to do things in different ways. And so that already contributes to an added difficulty. And so from a younger age becomes doing passing in more complex settings and in bigger settings. And it also, as you grow older, you learn to pass with different parts of the foot. And as your one question suggested, you learn to make more different actions compared to slightly different situations. And you learn to vary your action more towards smaller changes in different situations. So, you go from more of a basic, gross understanding of the game to a much more subtle and detailed, all the while the game itself is getting more complex.
Okay, you've given us so many things to think about, as usual, but just, I suppose, before we wrap up, do you have any final thoughts on passing?
Yes, I think the most crucial thing is what we mentioned in the beginning, which is don't practice passing purely for the sake of passing. Make sure that players understand that the main point of passing is to give it to a teammate who's in a better position. And that if we have teammates in a better position, then we must learn to pass. So for me, that would be the most key point. And that's also why I'm not saying don't use it, but passing count or points is something to be a little bit careful with. Because if you say, for example, 15 passes is a point, then you might have situations where you are encouraging passing for the sake of passing. The same goes for overusing a one-touch or two-touch maximum. Again, you're creating situations where we're forcing players to pass the ball. Players need to understand that passing the ball is a key action, but they need to understand the why of passing and not just perform passing because it's something that they'll have to do a lot of in the game. The more they understand it implicitly on a deeper level, the more likely they are to make good passing actions when they get to 11-11.
That was the voice of Maritz Kossmann. Thanks to Maritz for his time. And thanks to you for listening to the Soccer Coach Weekly podcast. For more from us, join us again next time or visit soccercoachweekly.net for practice plans, advice, interviews, and much more. I'm Steph Fairbairn. See you again soon.